This is Wayne Pond with Soundings. What are the characteristics of a good school and effective teachers? How do questions about certification and licensing of schools and instructors affect secondary education in the United States? Finally, how is it possible to attract good people to the teaching profession? The National Humanities Center looked into these and other questions in a series of conversations about secondary education in America. And Soundings now presents the third part in this series of discussions. The speakers are Dennis Doyle, Joseph Adelson, Carl Dulcy, and Donald Stedman. Dennis Doyle is Director of Education Policies Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Joseph Adelson is Director of the Psychological Clinic at the University of Michigan. Carl Dulcy is Dean of the School of Education at North Carolina State University. Donald Stedman is Associate Vice President for Academic Affairs at the University of North Carolina. Here is Dennis Doyle.
Well, I'll step in where angels fear to tread. I guess my view is that good teaching is an existential act. It is an act of commitment, of loyalty, of faith, both to the subject matter which the teacher is teaching, to the act of teaching, a statement of commitment to the student, and to the whole enterprise. Now, that sounds suspiciously like a religious calling. And clearly in mass education, you can't expect everyone to behave that way across the board. But if that becomes the standard against which you measure teachers in the art of teaching, it seems to me you can begin to make sense out of it.
Joe Adelson?
I don't think we ought to focus too exclusively on the personal and other qualities of the teacher, because as I read the research on effective schools that have been talked about, like Rutter stuff, and other material, I'm very struck by the importance of how the school, the ethos of the school, how it's administered. I don't mean this in terms of, you know, the ordinary management techniques, but rather its morale,
yes,
and how it's led, and the connection between the teachers and the principal, let's say. And I think if you have a good school, you can tolerate mediocre teachers. And I think good teachers, in terms of personal qualities, can have their effects, their potential effects, just washed out by a bad school.
Yeah, I think if you have the bad luck to have to choose between license and authoritarianism, which I guess George Will would call a fallacy, the false alternative. But nevertheless, if you were stuck with a choice of that kind, I would propose that the authoritarian regime is one more conducive to intellectual, moral, and academic development over the long haul than one characterized by anarchy and license. Those are extremes which are not very attractive. But there's another factor, too, which I think is very important, and I'm convinced that Americans in general, and the poor included, are empiricists, and they recognize that these big impenetrable bureaucracies are almost impossible to budge or to move. And in fact, if a parent goes into many schools and gets labeled as a troublemaker, the problems are actually exacerbated. So for the same reason that people very often don't vote, they very often don't feel that it makes any sense in terms of their investment in time and energy to try to influence the way in which these large social institutions behave. Now, that's true in reverse very clearly in fast-track academic public and private schools. Schools and parents have a set of reciprocal expectations for each other, and they deliver on them. And the degree of parental involvement, say, in an academic private school is generally pretty low in the terms of the quantity of time, because you don't need to do very much as a parent. I might call my kids principal or teacher once a year in the private school in which they attend, because everything does function smoothly, because the school is very expert at anticipating my demands and my kids' demands. If I, in turn, had to deal with a huge bureaucratic system, I would feel probably compelled to call all the time, but would have the wit not to, because I know it wouldn't do any good. So I think it's not just a matter of uncaring parents. I think it's parents who recognize the realities of dealing with large social institutions.
I think there's several other elements. One, in prior eras, parents tended to defer to the school. The parents simply reinforced the authority of the school. What happens today is Many parents substitute their own judgment for that of the classroom teacher or the principal, and there are challenges to classroom teachers, to principals, to superintendents, because people are unwilling to defer to authority. And I think that does affect the degrees of freedom that school people feel that they can exercise. And at least it's clear to me that school people feel that they can exercise a smaller degree of freedom now than they could 40 years ago. Schools could do almost anything 40 years ago, and most families would reinforce that, including, Joe, spanking the kids. Let's just take that simple act. Spanking kids today would create a furor that in most schools, and the parents wouldn't endorse that at all.
As we can, I'd like to get some more discussion going sometime about the point that Dennis made about the difficulty of penetrating the bureaucratic system in the public schools. I was very struck by this because about 20 years ago I did a study in the high schools, and I wanted to repeat that study this year, so I made some preliminary inquiries as to, same school system by the way, as to, you know, how I'll go about doing that. Now, 20 years ago, what I did was to call up the superintendent of schools and say, how about it? And he said, well, why don't you go speak to the principals? And I went to speak to the principals, and they said, sure, why not? This time, I'm told there is a committee which reports to another committee, and which will no doubt turn you down because they'll say, what's in it for us? I mean, they'll say this in a more bureaucratic fashion, but they said, they'll say, all we can get out of this is trouble. We can't get much out of it, and basically we'll hunker down. And if you hang around the schools, you get, this is not true of all, but I'm just struck by the number of situations you have where the attitude of the schools, even to people with essentially benevolent or at least neutral purposes, such as my own, I'm not going to do anything, you know, awful. I'm just going to give out a questionnaire. Is a sort of it's a hedgehog reaction. There's a sort of a feeling that I can be injured by this, and I will keep you at bay. And I think there's a very important part of the atmosphere of the school administrators at all levels in relation to its publics, both parents and teachers, and it has to do, I don't want to blame them or scold them, because it's a very natural reaction, it seems to me, given mm-hmm. the constant pressures they face.
Well, it's also a learned behavior on some of their parts. The people have coasted into the situation, gathered data, and instead of sharing it with the administrators or the teachers, it's turned out to be on the front page of the local newspaper.
That's right.
In some kind of NCAA box score about which grade is better than another grade, or which teacher, you know, and they get kind of gun-shy after a while. That's some of it. I'd like to talk about another kind of enrollment trend, you know, and I don't think it's divergent, but that is a concern that we have in education generally, and particularly in the South, for attracting better people into the teaching profession. The whole problem of developing incentives, or you know, we're having real difficulty in that area. Let me give you a couple of recent outcomes of our own look at our teacher education programs in the University of North Carolina system. We've got 16 campuses, 15 of which have teacher education programs, and they'll vary all the way from three or four small specialty areas to huge production activities like Appalachian State University and East Carolina University. While the university system overall has increased in enrollment by about 2-3%, each year over the past 3 years, there's been a decline in enrollment in teacher education programs on the order of 29% at the baccalaureate level and about 19% at the master's level, and consequent decline in degree productivity. Well, aside from the, you know, the implications of that for higher education structure and finances, the important element is why, you know, where are the students going? Why aren't they going into teacher education in the amounts or the numbers they used to? Our preliminary look at enrollment shifts suggests that the majority of the shift, which is the is related to the attractiveness of business and management courses at the undergraduate level, which is not unrelated to increased opportunities for women in areas other than traditional roles, but it's also in other public service areas, criminal justice, public administration, social work, parks and recreation management, the kinds of programs that are quasi-public supported or public supported. There are other systems, systemic organizations, prisons, corrections, and the rest. So it's not an aversion to public service or the helping role or the teaching role per se. It appears to be, if these interpretations are adequate, to be an aversion to the setting. And that includes the monetary aspect of the setting as well as the wages and hours, you know, in the classroom and the rest. And I think that's worth some really good consideration as an element in the whole matter of improving the quality of schools.
Well, I agree, Don. The problem, I see a whole set of problems there that really has not received enough national attention. First of all, there have been shortages of teachers in specialized fields for years, in spite of what the mass media have portrayed, and these shortage areas are getting more intense. Some of them are very intense nationally, like teachers of mathematics, for example, an extreme area of shortage, teachers of physical sciences. Secondly, good teaching has always been demanding under any circumstances. The good secondary school teacher is just rung out and carries a horrendous schedule in terms of demand. Teach 5 or 6 classes a day and 150 youngsters is terribly draining emotionally if one is really dedicated to the process of teaching. Yet one key to this is, it seems to me, and I don't think that it's politically feasible, but I do think that one key is to break the single salary schedule so that elementary and secondary schools can respond to market demands. And in areas of shortage, then they can pay higher salaries, and in areas of surplus, relatively lower salaries. Secondly, I think there's a need to look at the conditions under which teachers must operate. And you observed earlier, you know, it's in some school settings, the whole atmosphere seems to point against professionalism and against creativity and against initiative. And so when you put all of those together, it seems to me that we've got to begin unraveling the problems which are steering young people toward other occupations and away from teaching. My own projection on a nationwide basis, and I think it will be true in North Carolina, is that we're going to face an increasing shortage of teachers, not only in current areas of shortage, but newly developing areas, simply because there are not enough people going into these areas, even as replacements for people who leave occupation.
Yeah, I think a genuinely critical problem in this whole area is the artificial self-imposed barriers created by teacher licensing and certification systems, which exacerbate a problem which in and of itself would be bad enough. And I think particularly of the examples of, say, mathematics and science, in which teachers of teachers, say, a professor of mathematics at Stanford with a PhD in mathematics, could not legally teach in a California public elementary secondary school. And it's a barrier, given that example, which is on its face, I think, probably indefensible. So I do think some genuine rationalization of licensing and certification procedures and standards could help alleviate the problem. Certainly the split salary schedule would be a very significant step forward to permit public schools to pay shortage teachers more than other teachers. Universities and colleges have done this for generations. The California State Universities have just authorized such a practice now for business administration, math and science in their own post-secondary areas, and of course professional schools have done it for as long as we know about salary schedules. I think it also requires the exploration of a set of different organizational arrangements, adjunct or associate teaching relationships, genuine reliance upon part-time and or split-time arrangements, and some recognition that there has got to be some way to bring in the person who would not ordinarily be drawn to teaching into the teaching experience. And I think in this case, the key is licensing. I think of the principal advantage that private schools have is the fact they don't need to license their teachers. And the school where my children attend, the Washington Post music critic is also the dean of the art or the math department. And she is unlicensed to teach in anything but a private school. Now that is clearly a crazy situation. You might even think about some system of identifying exemplary school districts in which the superintendent or the principal could be permitted to make hiring decisions on up to 10% of the faculty without reference to traditional licensing requirements being met. But there have got to be some new ways to bring some new people in who would not otherwise be drawn into the profession.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to part three in a series of conversations about American secondary education. The speakers in this portion of the discussion are Carl Dulce, Donald Stedman, Gilbert Sewell, and Dennis Doyle. Carl Dulce is Dean of the School of Education at North Carolina State University. Donald Stedman is Associate Vice President for Academic Affairs at the University of North Carolina. Gilbert Sewell was Education Editor at Newsweek Magazine. He's a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book on American secondary education. Dennis Doyle is Director of Education Policies Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Here is Carl Dulce.
I think, again, as I mentioned earlier, it seems to me we've got to address the question of differential salary schedules. We need to address the question of the conditions for effective teaching. I can give you a very trivial example. As I visit schools, a phenomenon that I experienced as a student, as a teacher, still goes on, and that's a squawk box in the classroom. One of the biggest services we could do for teachers, I think, is to remove every squawk box so the teacher has the time in order to engage in teaching rather than in listening to some set of announcements. But I think that's part of the clue. I think also we need to really have some tightening of standards for admission to the profession. I think we need to instill in people a sense of pride and a sense of achievement, so that they are identifying with a segment that they feel pleased to be identified with.
Just parenthetically, Carl, do teachers think of themselves today as professionals?
No, I think they'd like to, by and large. On the other hand, when you get relatively little formal autonomy, and I'm making that distinction because there is really a lot of autonomy in teaching, in the sense that teachers go into the classroom and do their thing. But when one gets relatively little formal autonomy and little participation in many school settings in the decision-making process, and is served up with some cookbook, or for example, has no choice of texts, you know, if you look at all of the things that teachers are bound by in terms of the system, all of this gives them a message, and they have a single salary schedule. All of this gives them a message that they're employees in relatively large bureaucratic organizations. And I think that it's a need to, again, develop a sense of individual responsibility and professionalism that's very important. I would like to make one point about teaching and entry into the teaching profession. Very often there are a lot of criticisms, particularly on the secondary school level, of the deficiencies that people who complete teacher education programs have. And these criticisms all too often are quite valid. The criticisms, however, are very misdirected. in my judgment. They seem to be directed only at the teacher education component of university study. And if one analyzes who's responsible for teaching students to write if they don't know how to write, or to read critically, or to understand literature, and all of the things that we think are important in a generally educated person, these are not the responsibility in secondary education programs of teacher education. These are institutional responsibilities. And, you know, one might ask the question, how can someone complete college who can't write a coherent paragraph? And that's quite a valid question. One has to look at departments of English and say, how do you complete an English course? So I think that the problem here is a set of institutional weaknesses rather than only program weaknesses that we have to address if we're going to upgrade the entry into the teaching profession. And the same is true of command of discipline. If a person doesn't have a command of the discipline which one is supposed to be teaching, I don't know how one can really teach that effectively. That generally is a responsibility of the particular department, the mathematics department, the physics department. And where there are deficiencies, the finger should be pointed there and remedial action taking place there.
Well, I'll take it a little farther. I think we need a drastic reorganization of secondary education. It's essentially a cottage industry within the teaching education activity. Wherever two gather, you have a secondary education program. It's almost that bad. I know dozens of secondary education programs where there's one professor and three students. Now, it's hard for me to understand how a person could get a secondary education, in a teacher education, in, say, music education or in social studies education without having a larger critical mass of students and faculty. And unfortunately, these very small programs are more evident in the small private institutions than they are in the public institutions. And I think every institution, public or private, is trying to fatten its catalog to offer as many opportunities and options as it can in order to attract students. But in the process, they're spreading faculty so thinly across a large number of programs that they're not ending up providing much in the way of professional education for the students. Secondly, we have a dual structure on many campuses. We're moving to try to eliminate this in the University of North Carolina system, but it's hard to do. And by that I mean there's a school of education or a department of education in one part of the campus, and then there's a kind of infrastructure of secondary education, kind of a dual faculty. And that creates tension, it creates ambiguities for students, and oftentimes doesn't produce people who are well educated. Thirdly, I think that the best admissions criterion to a secondary teacher education program is a baccalaureate degree in one of the arts and sciences from an accredited four-year institution. I think that there's a great enough body of knowledge in pedagogy and education and in the disciplines now that you cannot cram them into an upper division undergraduate program any longer. And also you'll have more mature people. I'm not saying they have to have a graduate degree as opposed to undergraduate, approaching it from that angle, but they need to be older, more mature, more socially competent, as well as more soundly grounded in whatever discipline they are identified with, whether that's math or history or whatever. So those kinds of things, I think, are things that need to take place in order to increase not only the effectiveness of secondary ed, but I think those same things would attract better students into the programs because they would be more professional in their character and more effective.
Yes, but first you need the students. Who is going to replace that pool of bright women who for 75 years was the base of secondary teaching?
Well, go ahead, Carl.
I'd like to respond to that in the sense that I think sometimes we fail to understand that the market has to operate in education just like it has to operate in any other field, and that if one wants to improve things, then one has to screen out people who are inefficient. And when there's an acute shortage that comes up in a particular area, then and there's a response to market, then what will happen is salaries will improve in those areas and working conditions will improve. So I say that the only way that's really that we're going to get improvement is by having a sense of standards, enforcing those standards, facing shortages, and letting the market take its play. The problem is that whenever there's been a shortage of teachers, institutions have always pumped up their supply of teachers. In other words, they've always been simply responding, irrespective of the quality of students who were admitted or who complete. So I guess my answer to that, Gil, is that we have to, if we're going to make improvements, face some shortages, and that will force some market correction if the market has an opportunity to correct itself. If we don't allow the market to correct itself, then we're in never-never land.
The teaching profession is simultaneously the worst paid and the best paid, in the sense that by paying the worst teacher what you pay the best, you equalize the whole thing out in a way which simply doesn't make any sense in terms of our understanding of economic incentives. So some progress has to be made on that front, clearly. Secondly, we have a system which is, I can only be described as grossly over-administered, which contributes to the aura of bureaucraticness of public schools and diminishes the professionalism of teachers. I remember being amused in the state of Washington about 10 years ago when the local NEA affiliate tried to get legislation passed which would have the teachers of the state of Washington declared to be professionals by legislative edict. And I think language does speak volumes, so that the nomenclature that the British have preserved, and that is preserved in our private schools of masters and headmasters, tells us a lot about what they think schooling is all about. That in England, the teacher really is the master in his or her room, and the headmaster is simply one among a group of masters. Comparative data on administrators to teachers is difficult to come by, and the one bit of data which I like to cite, it may be apocryphal, it's so dramatic, but that is the story related by Bill McCready of the National Opinion Research Center in Chicago, who asserts that with 500,000 students in the public schools in Chicago, there are 3,500 administrators, and with 250,000 students in the parochial schools, there are only 35 administrators. And even if those figures are not as precise as one might like them to be, they do tell you a lot about the set of priorities between the two institutions. Private schools, Catholic schools in Chicago, have fewer administrators, not because they're more virtuous, but because they simply can't afford it, and they must of necessity rely much more heavily upon their teachers than public schools have had to do. And I would suggest that that creates a climate of increased professionalism among teachers, which is very much to the advantage both of teachers and taught. And I would suggest as a one-shot remedy, if you can't get a split salary schedule, which may be politically impossible, at least you can implement as policy the idea that no administrator be paid more than your best paid teacher, to eliminate the perverse incentive of siphoning off teachers out of the classroom and into administration. At least school districts could put their money where their priorities were and genuinely emphasize teaching in terms of remuneration.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for the third part in the Center's series of discussions about secondary education in the United States. a psychologist, an education dean, an academic vice president at the University of North Carolina, and the former education editor at Newsweek magazine provide the answers and insights. That's American Secondary Education, Part 3, this week on Soundings.